once again for tuning in to the Opening Bell podcast with me, Alex Steedman, and Matt Christie. Back with you once again, and apologies for the slightly belated appearance this week. That is down to the small fact that our wonderful, our great, our legendary producer, Darren Rees, is on the latest of his sequence of summer holidays. So we're coming out slightly later than usual. Hopefully that's not interrupted your week, your walks, your runs, your exercise, however you listen to us regularly. And we have got, once again, plenty to talk about. What it does mean is that recording 2 days on, Matt Christie has sealed, signed and delivered this week's Boxing News magazine, plus a bookazine, which is coming up in the next few weeks as well. So he is one happy camper, and I can see it on his face right here in front of me, how relaxed, engaged and ready to go that he is. Matthew.
Alex, it is. It's Friday, isn't it? I love Fridays. I was born for Fridays. I do. I mean, ordinarily, on a Wednesday morning, I can still be kind of feeling the hangover of quite a stressful Tuesday, trying to then put together the next issue, various things I've got to do on Wednesdays. It's all on my mind. So sometimes I'm not at my best on a Wednesday. But if I'm not at my best on a Friday, then we've got serious problems. I love a Friday. Sun is shining. I'm counting down until I take my beautiful wife out for dinner later on. I'm on cloud nine at the moment.
Oh, what a life. What a life. And with that in mind, Roy Creedy got in touch with us. Roy lives in Denmark these days, follows Boxing News, regular listener to the pod. Got in touch, slightly concerned that things were getting to Matt last week. He says, a short email to say, chins up, boys. You were a bit doom and gloom last week for our great sport. And I can fully agree why, being surrounded by comebacks and YouTubers for the past year. But let's take a look at the bright side. We just had a fantastic Olympics with GB boxing and also Ireland. We've got some good scraps coming up, even if they have been set up because of different reasons. If they come off, they could be worth watching. The girls are flying. We've plenty of crossover fights to keep us interested. Do what I do and ignore the distractions, even although, Matt, that's quite difficult in your day job. Keep them coming, boys. Carrying on and delivering a great pod and a fantastic weekly read. Thanks, Roy, for getting in touch. Yeah, there was lots going on last week, wasn't there, Matt? There was the sanctioning bodies, there was the YouTubers, and there was the great fighters of the past returning, I think the phrase I used, hijacking the sport. So everything kind of came at us thick and fast last week.
Yeah, it'd be lovely to kind of ignore the bad of boxing, but frankly, you know, as Roy identified there, it's impossible for me. I have to address the good and the bad, and unfortunately you can have weeks where the bad far outweighs the good, and but ultimately the frustration and the misery all stems from a lifelong love of boxing and a recognition of what a wonderful and great sport it could be if everything was just in order. And just a brief one on the likes of David Haye and De La Hoya and what have you, I don't blame them one little bit for coming back and taking, you know, this wonderful amount of money that's being presented to them. It's the structure of the sport that needs to look at itself and not make these things possible. But we won't dwell on that. Let's not dwell on that. The fact that we're talking about boxing, the fact that we will be talking about Manny Pacquiao and a wonderful performance from Dennis Ugas. We will be looking ahead in weeks to come to Anthony Joshua against Alexander Usyk. The sport has managed to remain relevant during a very, very difficult period. And as I have said several times on this podcast, we should be grateful for that.
And we like to regularly each week on the pod look back as well to reflect and enjoy of some of the major fights, the wonderful fights, fantastic scraps of the past as well. And this week is a very brief one, but it is its own version of Hagler Hearns, and that is Mike McCallum against Julius Jackson from 1986. So we're going to talk about that, in everything in and around it, before, during, after and subsequently as well. That's our This Week in History coming up. While we're on the emails, let me just read out one or two others as well. Mike Hills, and this got me thinking about, I meant to put a message up saying that the pod was going to be delayed this week, because I suppose you forget that for a lot of people, it does kind of become part of their routine. You know, Matt, you'll have other pods that you listen to, same with me. And, you know, whether you're in the car, you're out running, they do become facets of your week. And Mike Hill's got in touch with us, and, you know, a couple of hard days at work, likes to do his mountain climbing as well. I was thinking of Mike the other day that this, you know, this was would have been a couple of days late, and he certainly looks forward to his regular read of boxing news and the pod coming out as well. So hope you're well, Mike. Thanks for tuning in. With the news lines in mind, Canelo against Caleb Plant, the number one versus the number two in the super middleweight division in the rankings. That has been now announced, Matt. November 6th, it looks like it's going to be in Vegas. And that means in those international rankings, we will have a new champion crowned.
It's great news, the number one versus the number two in the super middleweight division. There was some talk that Canelo may go up to light heavyweight because the negotiations with Caleb Plant had stalled. And there were, you know, Dmitry Bivol would have been a perfectly appealing opponent for Canelo. But he has recognised, and what he wanted was to clean out the super middleweight division, so there's no argument whatsoever over his supremacy in that division. And I think that has to be admired, the fact that he will walk away from the super middleweight division, or he will be in a couple of months' time, if presuming he wins, of course, the number one in the division without any argument whatsoever. I think too often, in recent past actually, in recent history, we have seen the leaders of the sport go from division to division, from fight to fight, and kind of collect the belts as opposed to hang around and prove their supremacy like fighters of old used to do. So I think the fact that Canelo has made this move and they've made this fight, absolute kudos to Canelo, kudos to Plant as well. And this one, I think we were talking about this fight last November or last October when this looked like it was going to be Canelo's end of year fight for 2020. In the end, it was Callum Smith who got the nod. And I said then that I really like the fight. I still stand by that. Wouldn't pick I'm not going to pick Plant to win, but I think he has a few tricks up his sleeve that won't make it necessarily an easy night for Canelo Alvarez. And I really do like the fight. We're going to have to mention the fact that it's going to be for the undisputed title. And now and again, because of the sanctioning bodies, you get certain fights that perhaps you may not have got otherwise. I don't think if Plant didn't have the IBF title, then let's be frank about it, Alvarez wouldn't probably have been seeking him out. Then the other side of that, of course, is the fact that if it was just a simple ranking system like the one with that we recognise, that he'd have to, because it'd be one and two in order to become the champion. But all in all, this is another top-class fight at the top of a division where a world champion will be crowned, and we have to champion that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as a fight. Caleb Plant is coming out saying that we are going to be surprised how easily he's going to be able to win that fight. I said before when we touched on the possibility of it, I think Plant relies on speed of hand, and he thinks foot, but I don't think his footwork is as good as he thinks it is, and because of that his defenses are slightly lapsed, and I think he relies on all of that, and I think it's set up for an Amir Khan type spectacular knockout for Canelo. So that's my prediction, but we're a long way off that, of course, coming up on November the 6th, and we'll detail it, we'll go into the ins and outs, and there will be analysis and the build up to that fight later on. You mentioned the Bukazine, or I mentioned the Bukazine coming out, I think in the next few weeks, certainly in September, it's going to be available for people to buy boxing, and this really will, I think, prick up the ears of those who followed the Fab Four, and maybe someone who hasn't quite got the coverage that he deserves, perhaps.
Yeah, every 2 months we bring out a 100-page bookazine, and there's been various themes. The first one was kind of a look back on the Ali Frazier rivalry, all three fights, but we've kind of morphed into this kind of special where it focuses on one special fighter. We've had Mike Tyson, Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao was a recent one, Marvin Hagler when he passed away. with this one, it's purely devoted to the one and only Thomas, the Hitman Hearns. And the reason for that, my first thought was, well, we'll do one on Sugar Ray Leonard. But looking around, there isn't a great deal on Thomas Hearns that is just exclusively on Thomas Hearns. He's obviously mentioned in books on Hagler, on books on Leonard, books on Duran. He's mentioned in Four Kings. But there was nothing purely for him. And I went through the archives and located some really great stuff on Hearns. The whole bookazine begins with the first time that Thomas Hearns was featured in boxing news in any detail, and that is in 1978, when Thomas Hearns was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. He was 13-0 with 13 knockouts. And it's just fascinating stuff. So throughout the 100 pages, you have this archive content where there's some interviews that lots of people will not have seen with Hearns as he was making his way up, when he was champion, when he was kind of fighting the urge to keep fighting when he shouldn't have done. And it's fascinating. There's ringside reports, and there's lots of new interviews and new content in there as well. It's one that I'm really, really pleased with.
There is a Thomas Hearns book that I bought by Brian Hughes and his son. You may recall the Northern Trainer of the last couple of decades. So there is a book available, but this is I'm really excited about and looking forward to, because you do feel there's lots of kind of undelivered stories and narrative on Thomas Hearns, even although there's lots of the story that we already know out there. So that's coming out. News on the WBA since we spoke last week. There was supposed to be some, hopefully, some retrospection. There were some warnings fired across the bows by associations in America, internationally, regarding their behaviour over the course of the last couple of years particularly. And of course, it was brought up by some questionable scoring in a recent fight stateside as well. What's the latest on this?
There was an order as a consequence of the fallout from that particular fight that you're talking about, where there was some very, very questionable scoring and then questionable behaviour in the past of the judge in question. But basically what the WBA have come out and said now is that the interim belts, the interim championships, are no more. All of those boxers that held interim championships will be integrated into the ratings. The gold champions, though they will still have their gold belts, they, rather than floating above the rest of the rankings with the regular champion and the super champion, again, will be integrated into the rankings. I think you have to say it's a step forward for the WBA. It is still a ridiculous state of affairs. I think you've still got, if you look down at their ratings, you have still got something like 32 fighters that they are calling world champion in some way, shape or form in 17 weight classes. But that was over 40. I think it was kind of closing in on 50 prior to this announcement. And that means fighters like Daniel Dubois, Chris Eubank Jr. no longer have the interim championships. I saw something on the Sun website, actually, which kind of highlights how confusing the whole situation is. Daniel Dubois and Chris Eubank stripped of world titles. And that kind of just makes the whole situation far more complicated than it needs to be, really. And that's kind of what we're fighting against, is that as long as every other media outlet is calling these kind of belts world championships, then it's going to be very, very hard for Boxing News to make their voice heard, frankly. But anyway, to my mind, it is a step forward. There is no indication whatsoever, however, that there will be any change in the super and the regular championships. For me, that is what needs to be the next step for the WBA. But they have been saying this now for, I think, 6 years ago is when they said they recognised there was a problem. They were going to start whittling down the championships. But this is the first time since then they have actually taken any positive action and done something like this. So fair play to them for that. But it is still an incredibly messy situation at the World Boxing Association.
Does it give you, and we weren't intending to go into this, but does it give you hope that perhaps if there are shots fired across the bow, if there is a poke in the belly, that perhaps you can stimulate some sort of reaction? Or does it just feel like it's a kind of tentative appeasement rather than any genuine fear or desire to do anything about it?
I think it's a bit of both, really. I think you could argue, I mean, if it was Wednesday morning, for example, I might have said this was just a useless token gesture. Being as though it's Friday morning and it's the weekend, I'm looking on it a bit more positive. So I think, what I do think and what I have sensed, particularly since Boxing News is making the stand that it's made, is that the sanctioning bodies are aware, perhaps not as aware as they should be, but they are aware that a few of their policies, a few of their championships are creating problems for them, and that their perception in the world at large is not massively positive. I think my biggest issue with it all is just how hard it is, as we've said so many times, how hard it is for people from the outside looking in to make any sense of it all. And I do think that the sanctioning bodies are starting to understand that. I do know that each of the sanctioning bodies are well aware of what Boxing News' stance is. And I'm well aware that other people within the industry are looking at what we're doing. And discussions, like I said, when we made this announcement, there was immediate interest and immediate questions being asked by people. Some of those discussions are ongoing. So we hope to have some positive news in that regard in coming weeks.
I suppose what I'm thinking, Matt, and what I'm sort of leaning towards is, if the noise gets noisier, if the prods in the belly become a little further, if the momentum behind this gets bigger, is this that kind of reaction, is that just the tip of the iceberg? Does that give you an idea of where this might go? Well, of what the sanctioning bodies might be forced, inverted commas, to do?
I would hope so. I mean, I think the they're not going to disappear. Let's be frank. Unless somebody swoops in and buys all the sanctioning bodies, that isn't going to happen. But we have to get back to a situation where they're recognising one champion per division each. Four champions per division is ludicrous anyway. But where we were, or where we are, where there's 7, 8, 9 in certain weight classes is beyond helpful. So I think that steps are being taken. I think ultimately they'll have to make steps. They'll have to make steps because it does hurt the sport. It does hurt the sport, but it needs the key players at the very, very top to embrace it as well. It doesn't. I mean, I was looking at the Anthony Joshua, Alexander Usyk poster or kind of artwork that's come out to promote the undercard, and there's, you know, off the top of something like WBA international champion, you see this all the time. Just don't mention it. Doesn't matter. For as long as these sanctioning body titles are kind of being flagged up in all of the promotional material, the harder it is to move away from that. Ultimately, we just want everything to be very, very simple and contextualized as it should be contextualized, as opposed to being blown up to something that it really isn't.
Okay, I don't want to push my luck because we've got you in a good mood, so let's press on. But you did mention that AJ Bale, actually, and some people, you know, hardcore boxing fans, regular followers of the sport, and probably listeners to this podcast, a little upset or largely upset by the undercard for that AJ Bale, with the likes of Okoli defending his world title. Then you've got, what have you got, Campbell Hatton, Florian Marcoux on there. Callum Smith, perhaps. What do you make of that as a pay-per-view event below AJ against Usyk?
Yeah, it's not the best, is it? If we're going to be perfectly honest, it's not the best. The cynic in you wonders if it would have been a better undercard if it was on DAZN in the UK. The cynic in you wonders that. However, Lawrence Okolie against Prasovic, it's not great. I mean, Prasovic 15-0, not ranked in the world top 10. I think interesting to see how Callum Smith will get on at light heavyweight. But other than that, you're kind of scrambling around. I mean, I suppose some people might think that the Maxim Prodan Florian Marcoux fight would be a bit of fun. But honestly, my opinion on this is that this is a main event where you shouldn't be. You're not concerned about the undercard. You go back through history and you look at some of the greatest fights that there's been, and you never ever talk about the undercard. The undercard doesn't matter. For me, Joshua Usyk is top draw fight. And that's what I'll be interested in. That's what I'll be focusing on. And that's what, if I'm not there, which I'm hoping to be, but if I'm not, that's what I'll be paying the money to watch. Purely that fight. And that will be my own decision, because I think that's worthy of a pay-per-view in this environment. I think it's worthy of a pay-per-view event alone, the Joshua Usyk fight. I mean, to be perfectly frank with you, I don't particularly want to see 6 hours or 4 or 5 hours of nonsense anyway. I'm just there to watch that main event when it's that good. I think this discussion is more worthwhile when it isn't a top draw fight. When you've got someone like Joshua against Kubrat Pulev, for example, which isn't nearly as appealing as this one, or it wasn't going in. That's when I think the discussion is worthwhile. At this point, I'm more focused on the main event than the undercard. But yes, it's not the greatest.
I should say, for context, I mean, if anyone's followed the Canelo business, the Canelo career, particularly, I think it's fair to say, in his time with Golden Boy, you only had to look at those undercards on a regular basis to know that all of the money, the majority, most of the money, but largely all of it, was pumped into the main event itself. That you only have to look at those undercards, and I went to a few of them. So there is a kind of comparison. I'm not excusing it, but there is context and comparison there if you want it. It's not a particularly strong undercard, I think that's fair to say. And is it value for money, entertainment? That's a question that people will be asking. I like the idea, Matt, I've got to say, both in terms of televisually as well as just an event for fans to go to. I like the idea of it only being, say, half a dozen fights. I think that is a template going forward, if it indeed ends up being that as a template for both TV and attending fans, that is, for my money, absolutely bang on. The actual, what you're seeing, what you're getting, that's a different discussion entirely.
Absolutely. I mean, to my mind, I'd be happy with three fights, three solid fights, a top-notch main event and two really good fights underneath it. Now, I understand the business of boxing. I understand that you need to be building young stars up on this. So, yeah, I'm with you on that completely. I think being at Boxing News, it's interesting, particularly when you're kind of out in Las Vegas and you go to these fights, and the bill will start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And you say to the other journalists that are out there, oh, I've got to get over there for 2 o'clock for the first fight. They come in at like 8 o'clock at night for maybe the main event and the co-support. The chief support. And it's, as much as you love boxing, it's too much. It's far too much to have 7 hour cards. And I know they're not designed to get people in at the start. But it's kind of almost, it just doesn't do anything. And this is a story. I remember the first time I covered a card for Boxing News, and I had to be there something like 4 o'clock. No, it was about 5:30 actually. It was 5:30. Main event in the end didn't come on until about 11:30. And I remember about 20 minutes before the main event thinking, my God, what have I done? I kind of feared that I didn't like boxing after sitting through like 5 hours of an undercard. I just thought, and I was so drained. I was like, oh my God, this isn't for me. But very few people will experience boxing in that way. But I do think that you have to, and it'd be nice as well, wouldn't it? It'd be nice if the main event was to start something like 9 o'clock.
Absolutely.
9 o'clock, half nine. Just keep it in, like the rest of the sports, like the rest of entertainment industry. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a step in the right direction.
I think it might. I think it could end up there. What it will do is it does beg a question, because you know that the function largely of those long sort of 10, 12 fight cards leading up to the main events going on all day. They're part of the function of those is to service the roster of a promoter or manager. Part of it is to service the career of these young boxers, to give them the experience in four, then six, then eight rounders and so on. So it does beg a question, what then happens to those people? But that could have a positive spin-off on the small hall show circuit, couldn't it? It could actually work its way through the boxing industry to some of the other smaller promoters as well, who could put on these boxers that otherwise would have been on the May events as well. So although it might seem negative initially, actually I think it could work out for both the sport, the industry, all the way up and down the ladder.
Absolutely. And I think going back to Las Vegas, I think when they would have an event on the night before, the same promoter would have an event on the night before on a Friday night, and would service kind of some of the who would ordinarily appear on the undercard of the main event. I thought that was, I used to quite enjoy that. I used to quite enjoy that. And yeah, I agree with you. I think one of the things that has been not ignored in the last 18 months, 2 years, is how very, very difficult it has been for the small hall promoters and the fighters that predominantly exclusively fight on those small hall bills, is they found it exceptionally hard to get out there and fight. And there's some really good fighters that are fighting on small halls, but they may not have 2,000 fans that they can call on to come and watch them. They haven't got the backing of a bigger promoter. They haven't got the backing of a successful amateur career. They haven't got the backing of a network. So it is something that I think the sport can or should be looking to solve, and that would be by working together a lot more.
I suppose what it would, in terms of attendance for the big shows, it would rely on those 3, 4, 5, 6 fighters or 10, 12 fighters on the bill. It would rely on them being the draw, wouldn't it, to still bring the crowds that those other 5, 10, 15, 20 fighters on the long bills would have brought, a couple of hundred here, or 1,000 here, or whatever. But anyway, that's a discussion for another week. Plenty to talk about regarding the latest, perhaps, if you listen to him afterwards, the final performance in a boxing ring of Manny Pacquiao, who was defeated relatively narrowly by Jordanes Ugas, but I think he was outboxed, outfought in just about every department throughout that contest, and eventually Ugas winning it on the scorecards by 2, 4, and 4 points, Matt. So he moves forward. Questions now about Pacquiao's future in or out of the ring. You last week were thinking that Ugas could really draw Manny Pacquiao into a fight. I thought he'd be too easy to hit. In the end, we were both wrong. You thought Ugas could win it. I don't think you quite would have expected the performance and the manner in which he did it. Surprised?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't surprised. I'll be honest with you. I wasn't surprised. I did mention that right hand of Ugas, but it wasn't the way that I envisioned Manny Pacquiao losing. But it was apparent to me in the first round that he was just not quite right. Now, we know that he mentioned leg cramps afterwards. I think he said he could feel them from the second round. But look, go back and look at the first round. There's two things that you can identify with a boxer when they're of a certain age, where they're kind of struggling with time. They're not the fighter they used to be. The first one is the fact their reflexes have faded, and that manifests itself in two simple ways. One, they can't land the punches that they used to because they can no longer react to the openings that are there. And number two, they get hit more than they used to because they can't get out of the way of the shots that are coming. The other one is the feet. And this is the one that I noticed in the first round, is that Pacquiao was almost with his trademark marches forward, he was still doing that. Yet by the time the march had finished, he was kind of square on to Ugas. It was only a very, very slight misstep, but when you, in a boxing ring at that level, the slightest misstep will be punished, and that's what Ugas was doing every time with his counter right hand, whether it was a counter right hook, whether it was the straight right. His jab was always on point. He was never rushing anything. He didn't have to, because Pacquiao was always there to be hit. And for me, in that first round, there was some real warning signs. The other thing that I noticed was the look on his wife's face, pretty much from the first time that we saw her, and that was really early in the bout. And it was a look of horror that never disappeared from the first round to the last. She was aware that her husband was not doing the things that he ordinarily would do. And I think I've seen a lot of people say that Pacquiao could come back and win a rematch. Pacquiao can still come back and beat certain types of fighters. But the fact that his reflexes are not what they were, the fact that his feet and his timing is if not shot, they're in decline, tells me that that's only going to go one way now. The fact that the clock has caught up with him, the fact that clock that ticks in all of us is now showing his age, that clock will now only start to move a little bit quicker from this point forth. He won't be able to turn that clock back. So I think that if he does fight again, we will see that decline exaggerated. Unfortunately, I suspect we will see him, if I'm honest. I mean, I've seen some comments recently in the last day or so from Pacquiao saying that he can't believe he lost to a fighter. He said that he deserved to lose, but he can't believe he lost to a fighter like that. He wants to come back and potentially have a rematch in January, but he's going to take some time to decide if that is the option, because as a consequence of the contracts, that is there for him should he want to. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see him do that. I do think he should retire. However, as I tried to say in this week's Boxing News, we can't tell boxers to retire. We can't possibly put ourselves in their shoes, particularly a fighter like Manny Pacquiao, who has scaled so many mountaintops. It's ridiculous. For me, he's one of the greatest fighters who ever lived. And for him to suddenly be faced with this realization that he can no longer do what he's been doing since he was 16 years old, regardless of whether it was at the back of his mind beforehand, because he was saying, this might be my last fight, regardless of whether he has got this career in politics mapped out for him, and regardless of his family, who clearly adore him and he adores them, only he can take that step away from boxing at this point. And I think with some of the things that he's saying and kind of the confusion as to how he couldn't beat someone like Ugas, he may decide to go again. And that's completely up to him. I think my concern with Pacquiao, which I've alluded to several times, not just in the last week, but in the last few years, is the length of his career and the amount of violent encounters that he has been involved in. 26 years as a professional. He's been up through the weights. Just think of the time when he was knocked out cold by Juan Manuel Marquez. The other three ferocious fights he had with Marquez. That's before we even start talking about the trilogy with Eric Morales. Before we talk about his fight with Miguel Cotto, or the fights that he had down in the lower weight classes before he even moved up to super featherweight and announced his arrival against Marco Antonio Barrera. There were some really ferocious encounters that, sorry to say it, 95 times out of 100 will leave their mark when they get older. He's perfectly coherent now. He's absolutely fine now. He's fit as a fiddle now. That doesn't mean that he will be in future years. And I'm sorry to be quite grim about it, but he's already been in the danger zone for a number of years now about what state he's going to be in his later life. I just think he should stop. But going back to what I said before, it's not for me, it's not for anyone bar Manny Pacquiao to make that decision.
This isn't my opinion, because I think for all of the reasons and the points that you've given, I think the the decline in his abilities were evident through the first 3, 4, 5 minutes. It was so plain to see that he was falling over his front foot. His reactions were slower. He couldn't time anything at all. One of the worst things and most obvious ones, when you think about Manny Pacquiao, what do you think of? You think of explosivity, and you think when he lands his punches, they always have an effect. It was almost like watching Conor McGregor against Mayweather. There was nothing. When he did land his punches, there was just nothing there. It just wasn't Manny Pacquiao. But, Matt, is there any way that you could say he's been out of the ring for 2 years and he's in his early 40s, and that compounded and exaggerated in a significant way some and made worse the points that we're discussing now?
You can, actually. You can also throw into it, which I think this is what Pacquiao will be thinking at the moment, is that, yeah, as you identify there, he'd been out the ring for 2 years. The other big thing, of course, is that there was the change of the opponent. He was been trained. He had a full training camp for Errol Spence Jr., who was a southpaw. Ugas is not a southpaw. And to then kind of refine the training within the space of 10 days, where he probably only had, three or four days of real training before he was kind of winding down before the fight, was an impossible ask, really. I think it perhaps speaks of completely underestimating what Ugas could do. So ordinarily, if Manny Pacquiao was even in his mid-30s, I think you could write it off and say, okay, we'll go back and try again. See how you get on with a full camp. Now the ring rust is gone. See how you get on with a full camp while you're training for your Dennis Ugas. I personally think, as someone who has studied boxing history from when I was about 8 years old, and I look at what happens to fighters when they reach a certain age, I would be astonished if Pacquiao was to be significantly better in January. I saw Tony Bellew, I retweeted our cover yesterday, and Tony Bellew and our cover said something like, all that's left for Pacquiao to do now is say goodbye. And Tony Bellew commented on that tweet and said something like, we've been saying this for years about Pacquiao, he can come back. We said this when he fought Jeff Horn in 2007. That is a fair point, but that was also 4 years ago. And I think in the Jeff Horn fight, you could argue Pacquiao deserved to win it. It was just a horrible fight that Pacquiao got himself involved with. He didn't look like the fighter he looked like on Saturday night. There was no argument whatsoever that Pacquiao deserved to win that fight. I actually scored it 117-111 for Ugas. I was really struggling to give Pacquiao anything at certain points in that contest. It's certain points as well when it looked like Pacquiao might have got on top. There's a point in the ninth round, I think, where Pacquiao suddenly looks like he may be starting to get everything together. And Ugas just found it so simple just to kind of just take a step back and bop him with a jab and then bop him with the right hand. I'd be surprised if he could make the changes required at the age of 42 to win the fight. I mean, the romantics out there might say that it's all set up for Pacquiao for one more Manny Pacquiao miracle to come back, a la Muhammad Ali, perhaps, when he lost to Leon Spinks when he wasn't supposed to in 1978, and he was an old man then, Muhammad Ali. Yet he managed to go back and diligently train and managed to get one last miracle out of his aging bones and win a rematch against Leon Spinks a few months later. Muhammad Ali was 36 years old at that point. Pacquiao, 42. I just can't see it. I can't see it. And I think the day has come that we knew would come if he kept fighting, this day would come where Pacquiao, as we alluded to last week, would suddenly act his age.
It wasn't the eye-catching breakdown beatdown that we saw Pacquiao give De La Hoya. It wasn't the kind of eye-watering shock that when James DeGale suddenly completely stopped functioning as a fighter against Chris Eubank Jr. It wasn't either of those performances, Matt, but it was, I thought it was as shocking in a much more subtle way because of what you're used to seeing with Manny Pacquiao. I was shocked in a similar way to those, and yet it was in no way at all remotely connected in terms of a defeat. But I struggled to give him rounds, and he was just trying to force a performance out of himself. And I think the same signs and the same result, really, that you saw with both De Gale and De La Hoya, I think you've just seen that with Pacquiao in defeat against Ugas, just in a very, very different way, a more subtle way.
You there echo my words in Boxing News this week, where I listed some kind of some end of career horrible beatings. Just bear with me a second. The ones that I listed was Muhammad Ali's two fights against Trevor Burbick and Larry Holmes, the De La Hoya collapse against Manny Pacquiao, and I think. And I said, even though this fight, which are the ones that I mentioned, Mike Tyson against Kevin McBride, Joe Smith Jr. retiring, Bernard Hopkins. And I said, this was not as harrowing a bludgeoning, but given how well we know the Pacquiao of old, it can be argued it was just as revealing. And I think that's the case. I think the problem is, or the problem from Manny Pacquiao's point of view, or the problem from Manny Pacquiao's ego's point of view, is that he wasn't as one-sided and as horrible as that. If it had been, then he would not be having this discussion about coming back. We wouldn't be having that discussion. He would have just announced his retirement at the end of the fight, I would imagine. But the fact that you could argue he was competitive with one of the best welterweights in the world after 2 years out, and it was a change of opponent, then you can start to see how, in his mind, he will be able to justify one last run.
So perhaps we'll have to save our enjoy Manny Pacquiao career, celebrate Manny Pacquiao's career. Perhaps we have to just put that on ice. Just briefly, of the two great periods, I think, in Pacquiao's career, 03 to 08, when he's going feather, super feather, and having the fights with Morales and Barrera, and of course Juan Manuel Marquez as well. That period, or for me, the one that I particularly enjoyed was kind of 08 to 10 when he went 140 with Oscar and Hatton, up to 147, Cotto Margarito. That sort of two or so year period as well. For me, when he was blitzing everyone left, right and centre, that's the Pacquiao that I know and love. But there'll be plenty of people, young boxing fans, who maybe first got into him during that Morales, Barrera, Marquez period.
There's several phases of Manny Pacquiao's career where you put them all together and you have one of the best fighters of all time, like right up there with the legends of the game. So, I mean, we look at, first of all, we've got the super featherweight period which you're talking about there, where a lot of boxing fans, they first became aware of Pacquiao when he fought and he destroyed Marco Antonio Barrera in 2003. And I've said that he stands as one of the best super featherweights in history purely because of that period when he was fighting the likes of Barrera, Marquez, Morales. You have to recognize Pacquiao as one of the best super featherweights of all time, perhaps second only to Alexis Arguello. And then, for my mind, though, his peak, his absolute peak, was the period that you identified also, was when he moved up to welterweight. There was a pit stop at lightweight, then he moves up to welterweight and takes Oscar De La Hoya apart, follows that with a frightening demolition of Ricky Hatton, and then there's the beatdown of Miguel Cotto. Joshua Clotty came next, then there was Antonio Margarito up at super welterweight. But I think we first started to see the decline in Manny Pacquiao was against Shane Mosley at the MGM Grand in 2011. I was ringside for that fight. And I think that's when we started to see a few signs that Manny Pacquiao wasn't quite the fighter of old. They're only very, very, very slight. But I think during that period of 2008 to kind of 2010, 2011, I think Manny Pacquiao would have, he'd have competed with any welterweight in history. Someone tweeted me and said he would not, because it was when I was mentioning about Thomas Hearns, he said he would not have lived with a peak Thomas Hearns. Now you can say the dimensions would perhaps make that appear a mismatch. I'm not going to say here that Pacquiao would have beaten a peak Thomas Hearns, but I think if you're purely going to use Thomas Hearns' blowout of Roberto Duran as evidence, then you're off the mark. There's no way in the world that Manny Pacquiao would have fought like Roberto Duran fought that night. But I think that you can say that Pacquiao was one of the best super featherweights of all time and one of the best welterweights of all time. But when you're examining his overall place in history, you have to take other factors into consideration, like the fact that he started out as a light flyweight and was winning titles up at light middleweight. That's a tremendous achievement. The fact that he endured so many defeats and came back from them, learned from them, and came back. I mean, the fight against Floyd Mayweather in 2015, you could say that that was the fight that he was building for. And in the end, it was quite an embarrassing defeat for him. Yet he came back from that and put together and beat guys like Jesse Vargas, Lucas Mattesi, Adrian Broner, and Keith Thurman. This all just enhances his legacy. He was, for me, one of the greatest that has ever lived. And I hope we don't get that horrific, horrific full stop at the end of it that so many legends endure. I hope that he can now walk away. He can say it was a competitive fight. He's done everything he possibly can. I mean, let's say he comes back and he scrapes a result against Ugas. Is anybody then going to be screaming for him to fight Terence Crawford or Errol Spence Jr.? No. But perhaps he will need that victory just to walk away with his head held high. But I doubt it. I suspect if he was to come back and win, he will then be looking at what the next challenge is.
Watching that fight almost all the way through, in tandem with being shocked by Pacquiao's decline, all I was thinking was, what would a peak Errol Spence in the prime of his career, fighting as aggressively and positively as he does, what would he have done to Manny Pacquiao on that night? Let's return to Jordanes Ugas. The difficulty in, I think, analysing his performance, Matt, is offsetting the Pacquiao decline and balancing it with the really good stuff that Ugas did. And I know you weren't surprised that Ugas won. It's just I don't think either of us could have envisaged the technicality of the performance, the tactical nous of the performance as well, where he was standing off Pacquiao. He was looking to counterpunch. He was picking his shots. He was economic. He was efficient. He did so much good stuff. Was this the very best version of Ugas? Was it a better version of Ugas than we've seen before? Was it beyond your expectations of what he was capable of? Or do we have to balance it with what actually Pacquiao was able to do against him?
I think he was hugely respectful of Pacquiao. You mentioned what would Errol Spence have done with Manny Pacquiao. And it's quite a frightening thought, really. But I think that if Ugas had gone about his work slightly differently, he would have not been beyond the realms of possibility that he could have forced a stoppage late on. But he was so on point with the game plan. And you have to be massively impressed with him. Now, we had a discussion with the Transnational Boxing Board when that, because what they do is they put out their suggestions, what they suggest will happen with the rankings. Now, their suggestions were that Ugas would move up from number 4 to number 3, and that Pacquiao would actually enter the rankings at number 6. He was not in the rankings because he'd been inactive for so long. Now, I disagreed with both of those. I felt that Ugas against Sean Porter, the fact that
Porter won that fight. And I thought Porter just about deserved to edge that fight. It's still in recent enough memory that that Ugas stays at number four, and I didn't think that Pacquiao should come back in at all. As it turned out, I was outvoted. It's a democracy. And Ugas does move up to number three in the rankings, and Pacquiao enters not at six, but at number eight. And you can understand that. You can understand that. But I think we've got more to see from your Dennis Ugas. I think in an odd sort of a way, he could be even better than that. I think he was not fighting within himself, but I think he was very, very respectful of the Manny Pacquiao of old. And that almost tempered how aggressive he was at certain points. I thought Manny Pacquiao was there to be taken if Ugas had just gone up a level. Of course, we have to remember that Ugas is not a KO artist. He's only had 12 stoppages in his 27 wins. So the power may not have been there to do that. But I think that in a rematch, I'd be looking at Ugas to probably stop Manny Pacquiao. I think Ugas is a very difficult fighter for anyone in the welterweight division to come up against. And I think the worst thing about it all, and we did have a very brief letter that I felt we had to publish in this week's Boxing News, because the Boxing News editor's letter, the Boxing News report, the Boxing News front cover is all about Manny Pacquiao. It's all about Manny Pacquiao, yet your Dennis Ugas has just come along and won the biggest fight of his life with an excellent display. And the letter basically read, okay, Manny Pacquiao is a legend, we get it, but your Dennis Ugas won the fight. Let's hope he gets some credit for that. And unfortunately, Pacquiao's legend is so huge that the story is the fact that it may have come to an end.
And almost all of our discussion about this fight has focused on Pacquiao, and I think rightly so. But Ugas was terrific. It's just only fair to wonder how good he looked, how much of it actually was a kind of reflected glory on how poor Pacquiao was. But you've mentioned the rankings, the TRNB.org, I think, is the website for the Transnational Rankings Board. You can check that out. They're reappraised and updated every Tuesday. Matt's hoping to get that rejigged for the start of the week, so they can put the rankings in the magazine, so you'll be able to read and see those each and every week. But Ugas up to number three, having Pacquiao at eight, you can see why it's happened. Even though it was a competitive enough fight, even although I had it wider on the scorecards myself, but you can see the sense of that, even although you might disagree. And if you go on the website, what you will see is all the names and faces of all the journalists, stroke contributors, media men and women from all across the world. And there are nations represented, from Scotland to Puerto Rico to Bolivia to wherever. Sunny old England as well, with Matt Christie's bonce up there as well. And it's a huge international gathering, Matt, isn't it? So it is a kind of democratic collective, even although, like all democracies, you don't always necessarily agree with some of the policies.
No, that was it. I mean, my point of view on it was in regards to Manny Pacquiao coming back into the ratings. I can understand it, and I can understand why that was put forward as a motion that Pacquiao would come in at six, or that he would re-enter or whatever. But as I said, when I were making my point of view clear, was that if the number four welterweight in the world, which Ugas was going into the fight, had just beaten an unranked fighter fairly comprehensively, would there have been any discussion whatsoever to bring the beaten fighter into the rankings on the back of that performance? I don't think there would have been, to be honest with you. I think Pacquiao has been is in the rankings almost as a consequence of who he is in his career, as opposed to that performance. But I suppose that the fighters that he is above in the ratings, you'd probably pick Pacquiao to have just enough to beat them. But yeah, going back to the rankings, we will be getting them updated on a Monday moving forward, so they will be in the issue every week. I think it's important that readers can see them. But the rankings on the Boxing News website are the transnational boxing rankings as well. But yeah, go and have a look at them. I mean, I hope this discussion shows that even though we have adopted these rankings and we are involved in the decision-making process, it does show that it's a democracy. I don't necessarily agree with everything, but what we do have and what I have seen since I've been involved, there is a discussion, and there's clear and concise justification for every single decision. That isn't the case in the vast majority of other ratings that are out there.
And just to confirm, that website is tbrb.org. I had it slightly the wrong way around. tbrb.org. And you can read through that website. And there's loads of different facets to it, as well as the rankings list for each and every division. Just briefly, on the undercards, fellow Filipino and sort of would-be fledgling star that they're always looking for, the next Manny Pacquiao, Mark Magsayo, in the end, maintained his unbeaten record. He's now 23-0, his 16th knockout in 23 fights as well. Eventually, a 10th round stoppage of Julio Seja. If you just looked at the result, Matt, you'd be thinking, he's done it again, Magsayo, and he's an absolute KO artist, and he is the second coming, the next Manny Pacquiao. That's not what unfolded in that fight by any stretch at all. If you haven't seen it, folks, go back and watch it. It's a really good competitive fight. And Seja, who has now lost three out of his last four and has been stopped on three occasions. Again, the paperwork doesn't tell the whole story at all. Seja was terrific and showed up in a way that he's still got it or still got plenty, and he was very much on top of Magsayo until he got clocked late on. And credit to Magsayo, who found something from a seemingly unlikely position to produce a performance that didn't seem likely through the mid part of the fight after a blistering start from him.
Yeah, I mean, he came out and you thought he was going to do something absolutely spectacular. Magsayo, of course, has idolised Manny Pacquiao for as long as he can remember, as a stablemate now of Manny Pacquiao. And you did kind of wonder in the early rounds if this was going to be where he just scored this blistering win over a proven opponent. But then the storyline changed dramatically. He got drawn in and he was being given a boxing lesson, almost. And the fact that he managed to turn that around, he was dropped in round five. At that point, it looked like the more experienced man was going to win. And the fact that he turned it around in the 10th round, he was down on all three scorecards, to the point that I think he did need that knockout to actually win. The fact that he did that shows that he might turn out to be quite a special fighter. However, there is so much work he still needs to do to get to the very top. But he moves into the featherweight rankings at number 10 as a consequence of that performance. And I think that's perfectly, perfectly fair.
Yeah, he moves in at 10. That means Michael Conlan just drops out. Lee Wood's in at number 9. Gary Russell still 1. Lara 2. Warrington 7. Of course, they're facing up in a few weeks' time. Galahad 3. And I mentioned Lee Wood 9. I took a screenshot, Matt, of a tweet that Lee Wood put up in the last week as well, which I just wanted to read out to you. Obviously, his name's been mentioned by both Michael Conlan and, of course, that was that post-fight interview where Kid Galahad had a massive dig, didn't he, at Lee Wood's stroke, the WBA. And Lee Wood's tweet reads as this, hinting at a prospective fight, or whether it comes off or not, between himself and Kid Galahad. He said, "I don't even need to discredit him to beat him. He's a great fighter. I've always been behind him. Was ringside at Jazza 1, and I even once lent him my boots when he boxed in Ireland. Next summer, I beat him and unify. Doubt me, please." What a What a classy, classy tweet from Lee Wood, who, of course, was brilliant when beating Zhou Kan, just teeing up the possibility, stoking the fires in a very, very intelligent way for him v. Galahad. Of course, Michael Conlon's thrown himself into that ring as well. So things very much kind of heating up in the featherweight division. And great credit to Vermaxeo for pulling out of a performance. I wouldn't have been shocked had he quit on his stool or been stopped in that fight. It was looking that kind of result, but he found a way to win. And actually, when you look at the start of the 10th round, he just came out and got on it, didn't he? It was as if he said to himself, right, enough of this. Let's do something about this. I'm a fighter. We're in a fight. It's up to me. And he just grabbed that fight by the scruff of the neck and turned it around. Just terrific stuff. Go back and watch that. And, you know, we could probably have that on our This Week in History in a few years' time. Very briefly, Matt, because by the time people listen to this with our belated appearance this week, Akeem Ennis-Brown and Sam Maxwell may have fought on Saturday night. And, of course, Daniel Dubois and Tommy Fury in action on that Jake Paul Tyrone Woodley. Jake Paul picking on another aging, losing recently and debut professional boxer, inverted commas, brackets, call it what you will, Tyrone Woodley. So Daniel Dubois getting an opportunity on that undercard, and that's going to be on BT Sport pay-per-view, is it, on Sunday?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's over in Cleveland, and yeah, I'm sure that certain people will be interested in that. I think that from Daniel Dubois' point of view, it's purely an exercise in exposure, really. He will probably get a lot of eyes on him. His opponent does not look very good at all, to be honest with you. Watched him a little bit this week. There was talk. I mean, he kind of take the fact that his opponent was mentioned as an opponent for Mike Tyson last year should tell you all you need to know about his chances against Daniel Dubois. I'm sure it will do big numbers, particularly in America. How many people will watch it here, I don't know. But I understand why Daniel Dubois is on that bill, and that's all I've got to say about that. In regards to Saturday night's card in Birmingham, there's some really, really nice-looking fights at domestic level on that one. The best one that stands out for me is the one that you mentioned there, Akeem Ennis-Brown, 14-0 against Sam Maxwell, 15-0. For the good old-fashioned Commonwealth and British super lightweight titles, or I should say light welter in old money. But yeah, I mean that's a really, really good looking fight. But we won't say too much about that, because by the time you listen to this, you probably know the result and you know all about it.
And we've gone big on the Pacquiao Ugas fight as well. Time now to go big on a battle of the punchers in this week. And this week, we take you back to the 23rd of August, 1986, Miami Beach, Mike McCallum against Julian Jackson, two unbeaten explosive punchers. McCallum unbeaten in 26 with 23 knockouts, would you believe? Julian Jackson, 29 wins, unbeaten with 27 knockouts. Jamaican-born McCallum against the Virgin Islander, Julian Jackson, who came into this with absolute belief. The younger man at the age of 25 as well. This is probably one of those kind of forgotten, underappreciated fights, Matt. It only lasts under two rounds. McCallum defending his WBA belt at 154 pounds light middle, a super welter for the third time, and both would go on to be champions up in middleweight as well. It is kind of a version of Hagler-Hearns, isn't it, at 154 pounds? Because they just go at it right from the very first bell. Jackson just tries to put it on McCallum as soon as they come out for the first seconds of the fight.
It's really, yeah, I watched it again this morning, and I actually watched the last... Prior to that, I watched it last year, this time last year, when I used to do the This Week in Boxing, when there was very little boxing on, so we had to fill the pages somehow in boxing news. And that was one of the five fights that I looked at that week. And the way that Julian Jackson starts this, I mean, gosh, talk about the word kamikaze. It was like someone had a little whisper in his ear and said, if you do not knock out Mike McCallum in 3 minutes, we're going to kill your family. And he just went all out for it. And he actually did land that left hook, I think, in the first minute. I mean, McCallum's legs went, and it was just a brawl. But Mike McCallum was the one that was showing his class. And even though Mike McCallum hadn't had as many fights as Julian Jackson up to that point, McCallum was the more seasoned at world level. This was a time really when this division, 154 pounds, was still by and large regarded as a stepping stone between welter and middleweight. Like middleweight champions always had their eye on the middleweight champion in a similar way to cruiserweights were always thinking about moving up to heavyweight. But this was a terrific fight. Mike McCallum at this point, 26-0, was not as respected as he would become. I mean, in many people's eyes, Mike McCallum kind of was one of the talents that never really got a chance to shine. He was almost in what people might call the who needs him club, in that fighting Mike McCallum wouldn't bring you millions and millions and millions of dollars, so that he was kind of overlooked in a way by many people. There was talk about him fighting people like Thomas Hearns, Sugar Ray Leonard, as they were kind of winding down. It never, ever happened. McCallum did get to fight people like James Toney, but he never really had the fight that he deserved at the peak of his career. But this really is just a lesson to young fighters in how not to start the opening round. It was incredible to watch.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the contrast. You know what it was like, actually, to bring it back to the playground. It was as if someone, small 6-year-old child, whispered into the ear of other 6-year-old child Julian Jackson and just said, see McCallum over there? He just said, you're a sissy. That's exactly what it was like. And he just goes absolutely mad. And you're right about McCallum, because the interesting thing, when you watch back to the finish, because Jackson's kind of swaying on the ropes and he's got his high guard. But McCallum, the variety in his work, he's whipping in body shots left and right, trying uppercuts, then he's looping shots to the head. McCallum is trying everything to prise open the defences, and there's so much variety and composure in his work, even amidst the heat of the battle. What about the stoppage, Matt? You think it's the sort of stoppage? I suspect that the people would have been having a bit of a hoo-ha. Eddie Eckhart didn't have much to do in that fight bar, just kind of sit back and enjoy until the intervention when Jackson was on the ropes. He wasn't throwing much back, but you could see from his reaction almost immediately, Ed, he could have gone on. It didn't look like he was that badly hurt, brackets.
No, I think perhaps that the fight kind of lacked that definitive conclusion, and there were a few question marks about whether Julian Jackson could have continued. For me, watching it, the way that McCallum was, as you identify, mixing from head to body is another lesson for young fighters in just how to finish an opponent. I don't doubt for one second that if Eckhart hadn't jumped in then, he would have jumped in 30 seconds later with Jackson taking even more punishment or counting him out. If you kind of go forward a few years, as an example that Julian Jackson actually learned the lessons that were on offer from this fight, go forward to 1989 when Julian Jackson went in with Terry Norris. And in the first round, Julian Jackson took some serious leather from Terry Norris and then stopped Norris in the second round. Norris learned those lessons and went on to have one of the best careers of all time, 154 pounds. So many timelines with this fight. You can then go on with Mike McCallum, and this seemed to be the platform. The other time where I saw Mike McCallum wobbled badly in a fight is when I thought he was given the platform then to kind of go towards superstardom is when he took out Donald Curry. And he was hurt early in the Donald Curry fight, and then he scored an absolute howitzer of a knockout when he stopped him in the fifth round, Donald Curry. But yeah, I mean, this particular era is the era when I was just obsessed with everything boxing. and people at the time, kind of post the Marvin Hagler middleweight era, were a little bit upset that perhaps the quality had dampened a little bit in and around those weight classes. But you go back and you look at some of these fighters like your Julian Jacksons, your Mike McCallums, then you can look at your Sumbu Kalambays, your Terry Norrises, and in and around those weight classes at this particular time were some really good fighters. And as we saw here, some really good fights.
And you're also into the vintage clothing like me, Matt, as well, that the shorts were fantastic. Yellow with a lime green band for Mike McCallum, yellow red trim for Julian Jackson. And see the get-up of Don King. It was a Don King promotion. Don King with a little feather out of my cap, a little leaf out of my book. An all-white suit Don King was rocking in that one. Lou Duva as part of the Mike McCallum corner. Of course, he would go on to have that terrific unbeaten run of 12 fights over 4 years through the late 80s up at middleweight as well, where he beat Harold Graham, of course, Steve Collins, Michael Watson, Kalambe, who I think you have down as one of the unsung heroes of that era. He had a draw with James Toney as well. And a career that ended with 49 wins, 5 defeats and a draw. Never stopped Mike McCallum. And you look at those losses. 3 of the last 4 came against Roy Jones Jr. and James Toney, who were very much, you know, right in their prime. He even beat Jeff Harding, didn't he, up in weight at light heavy as well. So only lost to some of the very, very best. Kalambe was one of those names as well. So Kalambe, Roy Jones Jr., Toney, some of the only guys to ever beat Mike McCallum. And Jackson would go on to be a middleweight champion. Of course, that famous, infamous stoppage of Harold Graham in 1990, defended that WBC belt on 4 occasions until he bumped into G-Mac, Gerald McClellan, not once, but twice in 93 and 94, losing in 5 and losing in 1. He ended up with a record of 55 wins and 49 knockouts in 55 went absolutely insane. He has to go down as one of the punchers of all time, pound for pound. And 6 defeats. With the puncher sometimes comes the vulnerability, Matt, doesn't it? 6 defeats for Jackson, every single one of them coming by stoppage. And we finish up with that as a link, because all 3 of his sons went on to become professional fighters. I think most notably, boxing fans, certainly over here, I know we've got some listeners over there and around the world, but in 2014, John Jackson, his son, seemingly had Irishman Andy Lee in a bit of bother until Lee unleashed that right hook come up uppercut off the back foot against the ropes to stop John Jackson, son of Julian Jackson, in 5 rounds 7 years ago.
When people talk about the greatest one-punch finishes of all time, I hope that they remember that bombastic Andy Lee finish. I mean, you could say it was kind of born out of desperation, but the technique involved, if you really slow that footage down and watch it, is out of this world. That was an incredible, incredible night for Andy Lee, and it kind of triggered kind of almost this fairy tale finale for Andy Lee's career. And if anybody has met Andy Lee and knows Andy Lee, they'll know that he more than deserved that as well.
Yeah, and I think he meant it. And actually, watching, I went down a bit of a wormhole and watching it back, because at the time I thought it looked like he'd been wobbled. And watching it back, I think it might just have been a false step. He was certainly under loads of pressure, Andy Lee. But I think it was I think it was more calculated. And in line with what he was doing and what he was trying to do than necessarily I thought at the time.
Yeah, I think with Andy Lee, he's quite a tall and lean and lanky kind of fighter, and in a similar way to to Thomas Hearns, actually, who we were talking about at the start of the show, is that when you have got these big, long legs in a boxing ring and they're kind of trying to get out the way of a punch, or they take a punch, the effect can look more exaggerated than it really is. They can look a little bit clumsy when they're manoeuvring around the ring. And I think that was often the case with Andy Lee, and it was certainly often the case with Thomas Hearns. I mean, Thomas Hearns, some of those cane-like legs would look like they would bend and snap at times, yet he would kind of pull fights out of the fire, or he'd go through these incredible 12-round fights. And just to kind of finish with that and link it back to the Julian Jackson and Mike McCallum fight, is that on the undercard of the Mike McCallum Julian Jackson was a light heavyweight called Freddie Delgado, who perhaps told us in 1994 that the end of the line had been reached by Thomas Hearns when he drew Thomas Hearns into this horrible but thrilling 12-round fight. And if you are looking at the undercard of this one other name to mention that you may be aware of is Miguel Lora, who was a superb bantamweight. And that performance against Enrique Sanchez on the undercard was very, very special indeed.
Yeah, go look at that. Go down some wormholes. And that is our This Week. Make sure it won't take long, but it might just get you looking at other performances from Mike McCallum, perhaps one of the most underappreciated fighters of that era, and Julian Jackson as well. That's our This Week in History. Time to wrap up then. I just want to quote a couple of lines from emails that came in a few weeks ago regarding our sanctioning body and transnational board, rankings board discussion as well. James Long got in touch. He said, the disparity between the sport's potential for greatness and its current state is quite depressing. Along with the sanctioning body's issues, it seems that getting fights made between fighters from different promotional companies is also becoming increasingly difficult. Boxing News has taken the first step by making a stand. What else can be done to help the sport? And Marcus Bellinger with a couple of ideas as well. He's saying, personally, I think two world champions with the scope of a blockbuster undisputed clash and room for contenders to get a shot, having properly earned it, is the best way forward. I think if boards and commissions took a more principled approach to the spurious interim franchise and diamond belts, as the Japan Boxing Commission do, then that also could help. Both of those emails warmly received, and many thanks both Marcus and James for those. So that wraps things up. We're a few days slightly later than scheduled, but hope the wait was worth it. We got Matt Christie in the very best of moods. What does the weekend hold for you, Matthew?
Well, it's a rare weekend where I haven't got any massive work commitments. I will be watching the boxing on Saturday. I will catch up with the boxing on Sunday's boxing at some point. I was going to go camping, actually. I was going to go camping this weekend. I love camping. I've been known to go camping on my own. But I don't think I'm going to be allowed to, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. I think I'm going to have to go and locate shelves from this wood factory that my wife has identified as a must visit. So that I suspect will be what I'll be doing is making shelves. Once I've taken her out for dinner tonight, of course.
Romancing the stone. Very good. Well, good luck. Good luck, whichever way.
What about you, Alex? What are you doing this weekend?
I've got a little bit of work that I'm doing today, and I'm actually off Saturday, Sunday. I've got a prep, a little bit of prep. I've got racing on Monday that I'm on the race course. So I've got a little bit of prep. Well, no, not a little. I've got a lot of prep to do, but I'll balance it out over the 2 days, watch a bit of boxing, hopefully do a little bit of gardening. But wherever you are, and actually, folks, however you listen to the pod, get in touch with us and let us know how it is that you listen to the pod, whether it's on the treadmill, while you're out walking the dog, while you're running, exercising, or as Mike Hills usually does, while he's walking up mountains in Colorado, get in touch with us, theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. However you do it, whatever you're doing over the weekend, enjoy yourselves. Take care.